This is the beginning of class 2.
Sasi Bhagi Jushimeta Jam Vira Vinci Nyande Yampadi Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Jogu just hold it and listen. All right. Last time we talked about the three refuges. Sometimes they're called the three places of refuge, the three jewels. There's a difference between the jewels and the things themselves. Like the Dharma jewel and the Dharma is not the same thing. Right? I mean, this is Dharma. The books are Dharma, but they're not the Dharma jewel. Why? The Dharma jewel can only be two things.
It's a movement inside your mind.
Yeah, either a path, which is a thought, which is an attitude, or a cessation, which is the ending of some bad quality in your mental stream forever. So, yeah. Although somebody was debating me in New Jersey, was pretty good debate. You know, how can you have both? How could one thing be both? It's very difficult. So anyway, one is an absence, one is a mental. But I'm not going to get into that. Anyway, there's a difference between the jewel and the thing itself, like the Dharma and the Dharma jewel. So we talked about the things that you go to refuge to. Now, today we're going to talk about what it is to go for refuge. What is going for refuge? Okay. You hear it a lot in, you know, every Dharma teacher who ever comes to New York for those two-day lightning visits, you know. They say, oh, take refuge, you know, and everybody goes, I take refuge in Buddha Dharma. Okay, your name is Yeshe Sundri, you know, bye. And then, okay, the taking refuge is not the words of taking refuge. There is a vow of taking refuge. That is not taking refuge. That is what we call in name only it's taking refuge. It's a kind of taking refuge, but it's not the taking refuge. It's not the real taking refuge. We call it nominal taking refuge. This is the real taking refuge. This is the real definition of taking refuge here. Okay, so try it. Repeat, okay?
Yu
Shenla
Shenla
Rangtopki
Rangtopki
Rewa
Rewa
Chawe
Chawe
Semba
Semba
Kamjoy
Kamjoy
Tenyi
Tenyi.
That's the real meaning of what it is to take refuge. Okay. Now I'll explain it. Yule means an object. Yule means an object. Shen means another, something other. La means two.
T-O.
La means two? Yeah, T-O. Tibetan is easy. When you learn Tibetan, you'll find out that La means two, four, on, at, in, for the length of, for the duration, and it. All of those are one word in Tibetan. At, in, for the length of, for the duration, and it. All of those are one word in Tibetan. La. Rang means itself. Chok means power. What's Tokke men? What do you guess is the elixir? What do you call it? Tokke men, the herb for generating strength. What do you think that's a translation for?
Vitamins.
That's a Tibetan. That's their word for vitamins. Okay. So Tok is what you get from vitamins. Tokke. Ki means of. I'm sorry, by. Rewa means hope. It's a saying in Tibet, famous saying. Rewa gyamnam yorincha. Once you get your hopes up for something, you never get it. Rewa, hope. Chawa means to put all your hopes in something. To put all your hopes in something. And Semba is a very difficult word to translate. It means any time the mind moves. Any movement of the mind. Any time the mind goes kick. I call it movement of the mind, but it sounds a little bit too much like bowel movement. So I think we might have
to...
That, maybe, you know. I mean, you think about it.
Is that
it's close to thought, but you see... I almost used the word thought, and in one case I did use the word thought, and you'll see. But not all sembas are thoughts. Thought implies a mental verbalization. I thought to myself, I better get out of here. But semba can be just like a moment of anger is semba. You know, any time the mind does anything, that's semba. So it doesn't have to be conceptual. So that's a hard thing to translate. Some people have made up a word called meditation, and I don't like it too much. It's not English. Okay. Gyamdo means going for refuge. Gyam means refuge. Do means going. Gyamdo.
That's the Y at the end?
Yeah, Gyamdoi. The Y makes it of. It's like apostrophe S. That Y is apostrophe S, like John's. Yeah, going for refuge to this. Tseni, definition. Tseni means definition. Okay, you are now Tsenipas. Tsenipa means a monk in the monastery who isn't just doing easy things anymore. He decided to become a logician. Okay, so Tsenipas. I mean, monks who go in for the deep studies, they call them, the name they call them are Tsenipas. They are now working in the realm of definitions, precision. They are. So you're into that. I hope you like it. But that's the way it's going to be. That's my training, and that's what I'm working on.
Tenyi is definition.
Yeah, Tenyi means definition. So now we'll translate, okay? You can say that thought for now, but thought. In Tibetan, you translate backwards, okay? Tibetan order and English order are completely backwards. that thought in which you put all your hopes in another object, and I don't know how to say it in English very well, but that thought should be of its own power. And we'll talk about that. Of its own power. It goes by on its own power. And I'll explain it. You'll never figure it out. I went and asked my lama to make sure I had it.
Sorry, that thought will be?
It has its own, it's on its own power. And we'll talk about that.
So you're saying that thought, which has its own power,
that thought,
which
has its own power, puts all its hopes into some other object. That's what it is to go to refuge.
So we can scratch out in which you put all and replace it with.
There's a nice definition in your reading at the back of the notebook. So you know there's a clean definition back there. I'm giving you the
I got tested taken, and I want to make sure I get it right.
That thought, which of its own power,
which
puts all its hope in another object, the definition. And in the monastery, I mean, you'd be like, show. You should not under the other side. You'd have to, you would have this class in the morning, and then by evening, you'd be expected to be debating for like 4 hours. And then you wouldn't forget it for your whole life.
Do they take notes, or is it?
They don't take notes. They read the book with the teacher, and then they go home and think about it. And then in the evening they have to debate it for maybe 4, 5, 6 hours. And then you never forget it. After, you know, if you debated it, you don't forget it easily. It's a very good system. You memorize the root text before you go to class. They might memorize the whole thing. Okay, so that's what it is to go for refuge. That's what it means to go for refuge. Yul Shen La means some other person or thing outside of yourself, obviously. When you want protection, you usually go to something other than yourself. You go into something else. The reason you go for protection is that you don't have the power. The reason you're taking protection, taking shelter, is that you're going to somebody else for help because you don't have it. You don't have the necessary power, or you wouldn't have to go for shelter. You could stand there and fight whatever it is yourself. That's refuge. That's the idea. Refuge means running away to something that can help you.
Well, this is going for refuge as opposed to having refuge.
Yeah, this is the definition of going for refuge. We talked about refuge already. We already talked about what you run to. We talked about mummy. Now we're talking about what is it to run to mummy? What does it mean to run to mummy? So this is going for refuge. We'll skip Ran talking right now. Rewa Chawai Samba means to put all your hopes in that object. All your hopes. And that implies some kind of commitment to that object. You really believe that that object has the power to help you. Total conviction that that object can help you. And that's why you go to that. That's why you run to that object. So I think we mentioned it last time. There's two things going on when you take refuge. Kylie, give me one. There's two, what they call two elements in refuge. There has to be two things present for refuge to take place. Why do you run to mommy?
Because you're afraid.
Yeah, you gotta be afraid. Fear is the first requirement. First requirement is fear. You're afraid of something. That's why you're running for protection. And then what, can you guess the second part? That you must have. The belief that that object can help you. The reason you run to mommy and you don't run to your sister is mommy's big and mommy has authority. Mommy can do something. You know, she can do something about it. Well, little sister can't help you. You don't run to little sister, you run to mommy. So there's two things going on when you take refuge. The first is included here. When I say Yul Shen La, some other object, it means someone outside of myself. I'm afraid. When I say Rewa Chawai Sampa, I believe that object has some power to help me. There has to be two things going on when you take refuge.
That's not what we're talking about here.
tell me.
So we talked. You lost me. The difference between the object of refuge and the going for refuge. Mm. So I'm
mommy and going to mommy. Tonight we're only talking about going
okay.
to mommy.
So it's
last
not
week
the,
we talked about mommy.
The noun and the verb.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Going for refuge. Taking refuge.
Okay.
Going for protection. There are two. That's why this week we split the class into two parts. The first class was all about Buddha Dhamma Sangha, jewels. What is the object of refuge? They call it object of refuge, or place that you go for protection. We finished that. Now, what is it for you to go there? You know, what do you have to have in your mind to go there? When they say have refuge, it means you have this state of mind. And that is that state of mind. That's what refuge is. It's not the word of
have refuge, the verb, or have
when
refuge,
say,
the noun?
When you say have refuge, what you mean is taking refuge. If people say, do you have refuge? They say, are you taking refuge? Which means, are you running to mommy?
Okay.
Yeah. It's not, refuge is there. The refuges are there. Buddha is there, Dhamma is there, Sangha is there. They're like a, there's a joke in Tibet, in the Lamrim. They're like a big, what do you call that out in a picnic ground where there's a big, no walls, just a roof. What do you call it?
Pavilion.
Yeah, pavilion. Yeah. So you're standing, there's a pouring rain, and the pavilion is over there, and you stand in the rain, and you go, pavilion, 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 pavilion. So that's like most people, most Buddhists are like that, you know. And then walking under the pavilion, out of the rain, is going for refuge. That's the mind. That's the state of mind. It's not the You have to say that, but you have to have the thought going on at the same time. So what does it mean? By the way, this is not the definition of Buddhist refuge, going for refuge to a Buddhist refuge. This is just the general definition of going for refuge. And that can be divided into two kinds. One is going to refuge to normal things, and the other is going to refuge to ultimate things. So people in the world, all day, go to refuge to. We take refuge all day in normal things.
Yes,
right. That's the problem. Everybody takes refuge all the time.
Yeah, no. And so this,
the object that you're taking refuge to.
This is not this is not the goal. This is the definition of taking refuge. It's not the definition of taking Buddhist refuge.
Taking actual refuge.
This is just any refuge. This is what it is. We take refuge all day. You take refuge. Anything you think you that can help you. You are taking refuge in all day long. I think it's important to understand all day long you are taking refuge. The reason you get out of bed is that you want to go to work because you think money is a refuge. And it is, in a sense. It pays your rent, it feeds you. That's refuge. That is a refuge. And if you didn't have Rewa Chawai Semba, if you didn't believe it could help you, you wouldn't get up and go to work because it's not fun, right? Most times.
Okay. It's funny though.
That's why they pay you. Because they have to get you to come. That's the real Chari Samba. That's you have that. Or you take refuge in, say a coat. You have a coat. You take refuge in your house. You take refuge in your friends, your wife or your friends, or your children, or your career, or even your own self, your opinion of. These are all refuges.
Would you take refuge by not taking refuge in Dharma, which is what a lot of people do.
No,
they believe that if you take refuge in Dharma, you're going to get yourself in trouble. You know?
Yeah. And all of those objects that I talked about, all of them, all of the reason that you get up in the morning, and all of the reason that you walk around the street, and all the reason why you go to work, all the reason why you meet your friends, all the reason why you do anything is worldly refuge. You're taking refuge. Every action you do has some motivation to get something, or you wouldn't do it.
Presumably, everything you're doing is going away from suffering and toward something good.
Right,
at
and
least
every,
that's what you think.
Every object that you put your hopes in is temporary. It can't help you. It will not help you. And we just live like fools. Our whole day is like foolish. None of the things that we work for can help us. None of the things we get up out of bed for can affect us. You get money by going to work. It's not because you got up out of bed to get the money. It's from what?
Past karma.
No, you get You get it? We have a whole wrong idea of why things are happening. That's one kind of ignorance. It's not the ultimate ignorance, but it's a pretty heavy, it's a very thick ignorance that we have. Everything we do is mistaken. You know, we think that through effort or getting waking up and doing blah blah blah, we're going to get money. But some people do and some people don't, so it's not a cost.
So if we stayed in bed tomorrow morning, we get the money anyway.
You would. You could. If you were virtuous. Yeah. Yeah, some people just goof off and the money pours down. You can see it in the world. Some people work. I mean, go to Asia, watch the people work in the rice fields. And they're working much harder than any of us. And they're starving. There's no relationship.
But those could be like national karmas or larger karmas,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what they are.
Yeah. So it's not related to how hard you work. It's not related to how intelligent you are.
We just got
intelligent people
here.
Who are poor, they're stupid people who are rich. It's not a cause. It's not a cause. I always say, people got on an airplane and the stewardess said, your seat number is 12B. By the way, we don't really understand why this plane runs and it might fall down. Don't mind. Just it works some of the time. Some of the time it falls down. Will you get on? But your whole life is like that. You believe that going to work will get you money, but sometimes it doesn't. So that's not the cause of you getting money. That's not what caused the money. It's crazy. It's ignorant. Okay.
That's very funny.
So that's going for refuge. Yeah, tomorrow I'll stay home. I'm going to. Michael's
going to. Do you
just
have refuge as well? They
call it exceptional refuge. Special refuge.
That's Buddhist refuge.
And that's Buddhist. That's where you go to a real refuge. What do you go for refuge to? They call it exceptional refuge. We got to be careful with our words because ultimate has a different meaning, direct has a different meaning. Yeah. Yeah,
so that's
careful.
Just Buddhist refuge.
We can call it exceptional refuge.
Exceptional refuge is always Buddhist refuge.
Yeah, what they call special refuge or exceptional refuge.
And it's going for refuge in
those
three jewels.
Is the other one ordinary refuge that we were just talking about?
Yeah, all of those ordinary. When you read the Tibetan text, they'll say going to refuge to worldly spirits, which exist, and you can propitiate them, and you can appease them, and you can get a little. Sometimes they'll help you, and that was the example in Tibet. And also, but this definition fits all of our daily activities. Basically that. Okay, that's what the definition of going for refuge. If you supply the words, basically if you plug in the words three jewels, then you have the definition of Buddhist refuge. Exceptional refuge. And we don't do that. Alright, now.
Kiru.
Chung.
Chung, Trin, Chenpo, Sung, Kebu, Chung, Trin, Chenpo, Sung.
Kebu means person. Okay, person. In Buddhism, that can mean an animal also, but not in this case.
Can it mean anything else? Like a
no.
Being or
yeah, oh yeah.
Being.
Okay, any being.
Sentient being?
You could say being. There's another word for being. What I'm trying to say is that the person is in Buddhism not limited to a human. A dog is a person too. Long story. Kibu. Chung means small. In Tibetan, how they say small? Chung chung. Chung chung. Jing, you had last class. It was one of the three kinds of sutras. Do you remember?
The middle.
The middle one, okay. Jing means middle. Medium. Chenpo, you know. Chenpo means big. Su means three. These are three levels of practitioner. They're very famous. They're in the long room. And they are, we're going to talk about five different kinds of refuge, five different kinds of going for refuge. And these are the first three. Okay. Kebu Chung means a little person. Medium person and a big person. You can call it, if you're writing a book, you call it practitioner of advanced scope. But think of it as a little person. All right, right. Little person means the person with the minimum motivation for a Buddhist. He has the minimum thought you can have and still be a Buddhist. He has the smallest, lowest motivation that a Buddhist can have. And that's that he wants to get out of the three lower births. He does not want to go to the three lower births. Okay, what are they?
Hell.
Animal. And what we call preta or hungry ghost. Okay. Buddhism is not stupid. Buddhism doesn't say you can see these two. Buddhism says you can't see these two right now if you're just a normal person. I cannot prove to you that these two exist. Okay. And the books say that over and over again. They do exist. The Buddha said they exist. You can see them in certain states of meditation. But I can't prove it to you, and I can't show it to you right now. So take it as the word of the Buddha and doubt it, okay. But at least you can see animals. So animals, hungry ghosts, which are spirits that we can't see. They live around us. We can't see them. They have bodies. They're very subtle bodies. We can't see those bodies. Probably what Western people say, they've seen ghosts or spirits. Probably they saw something. And then hell being, which you can read about in the Western religions also. The descriptions of hell in the Abhidhamma Kosha and the descriptions of hell by Dante or the Christian writers are exactly the same. So it's pretty interesting. I would tend to think that people in each religion had seen them directly and described them. Some people struggle to say that the Greeks met the Kashmiris and somehow this myth covered, or they say, oh, hell is just a metaphor. That's very wrong, by the way. It's not just a metaphor. It exists. Very wrong. Very wrong.
Tibetan monks, I know. Don't believe in hell.
They don't have a direct experience. No, it exists. I haven't. Well, I mean,
they did. They believed it until they went to the monastery, and it was after years of sitting in the monastery that they began to disbelieve.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Just repeating.
No, the great text Nagarjuna outlines hell in his Sirveka in 200 A.D. The Buddha describes hell in detail in his Jataka tale. The Abhidharma, the third chapter, spends many pages on hell, and it exists. It does exist, and you know it exists because you know about emptiness, and you know the four principles of karma. You can imagine that it exists. If those four principles of karma are true, then a perception of yourself hurting someone now could cause you to have a perception much greater, you know, much more intense, and much longer. I mean, the hell's, according to the scriptures, the life of a being in hell is very, very long, extremely long.
Are hell beings, I realize I didn't know this today, when I was writing out the answer to that, one of the questions on the heart. Animals have mothers and are born in a particular way, and so do our humans. Do hell beings, are they born in the same way?
Abhidharma, third chapter, explains four kinds of birth. There are four ways of taking birth. And one is called Dzitikyo, which means you just appear in that place. Like Padmasambhava was Dzitikyo. That's why he's called Padmasambhava, because he was born from a lotus. Some saints are born from a lotus. So
the lotus born.
The hell is in hell you just appear there, and your body has special qualities. You know, they can torture you and kill you, and then you'll revive again, and then they torture you and kill you again, and then you revive again.
You don't need a mother.
No, in hell they don't have. Hell beings are ridiculous.
You have someone to torture instead.
No, it exists, and it's not funny. If you ever get a glimpse of it, it's terrible. It's horrible. It's like just fire, and much more painful than this fire on earth. They say much more painful.
Can I see something?
Don't you? There's a long description about that. What lights you see and things like that. So very long description, good description. And in fact, when you reach the higher levels of practice, you need to know about that because you need to use it. Okay, Gebu Chung. So these people, the lowest Buddhist motivation is to get yourself out of those three births.
like a small skull.
Yeah, small skull. I like that word. And that's what's in the text, smaller skull.
Can you say by extension also that, you know, not just to always be reborn as a human, but at least, but, you know, a decent human as well?
No.
They don't care. As long as I'm in the human realm.
They no, not even human. They can be in higher than human also. But they don't want, they do not want to go to one of those three lower births. They will do, they are living this life. Their life in this world is dedicated not to being born there.
What makes you go
be born in a lower realm?
It's bad deeds. Ten bad deeds, basically. Check the calendar.
Okay.
I mean, those are 84,000 deeds. Yeah, if you want, you want.
So, but it's about life?
Morality. Do these and you don't go. Do them, don't do them and you go.
Well, these being
do not have long sex.
A boat destroyer, is that what this is?
No. No. This is just any person who's...
What's wrong sex, Michael?
There's lots of them. There's two pages of wrong sex.
Question better would be what's right then.
Shorter page.
You can check the calendar. Huh? This is the text of the calendar without the calendar.
It doesn't say by
the
way.
No, just, well, you can take out all the ones there and whatever's left. Okay.
Thank you.
Do not lie. I mean, everybody lies. Is everybody going to go to hell?
According to scripture, 99.999% of all people will go to hell.
Wow.
That'd be an awesome
thing. That's funny. No, that's funny. No. I mean, there's good intentions to help, yes. I mean, for example, there are non-Buddhists who commit suicide after doing some kind of special prayer in India, in ancient India. And they thought that was... It's actually a great bad deed. But they thought it was nirvana. They thought it was how to get to nirvana. So actually, from the point of view of motivation, that was a virtue. So yeah, if your heart is in the right place, it's a long way from, you know, not taking it. We'll talk about it. So that's the motivation of the smallest level of practitioner. Okay? I went to a lecture in Arizona. The Dalai Lama spoke during the day, and some other people spoke at night. And after I came out, something bothered me. You know, something bothered me about the lecture, and I thought about it for a long time, and I thought, this is not a Buddhist lecture. They didn't mention next life at all. They're talking about how to be happy, well-balanced, you know, friendly, you know, just how to be kind of cheery in this life. And it just occurred to me, that's nice, but it's not Buddhism. You know, the minimum practice, the minimum reason to go for refuge is concern about what's going to happen when you die. That's the minimum. If you don't have that, you're not a Buddhist.
Not your Mahayana, all Buddhists.
No, any Buddhist. That is the minimum attitude to be called a Buddhist. And that's why there's this joke in Tibetan, or there's this supposedly true story that there was an abbot of a major monastery up on the throne, and some humble monk had, you know, he had the power to read his mind. He said, you know, that abbot's not a Buddhist. He's not motivated by this minimum motivation. Yeah.
Yeah. Then that's the minimum goal, and the minimum motivation is fear, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
I mean, the minimum goal is to not be born in the lower realms.
Right.
The motivation for the minimum goal is fear of being born
right.
in the lower
realm. And to do the right things in this life after death. And you're young, you don't think that's such a relevant goal. You'd rather have something to work on that's going to make you happy or satisfied or even contemplative in this life. It's not the goal. You will get everything you wanted in this life as soon as you get that. The deeds that you have to do to keep yourself out of hell are exactly what's going to make you very happy in this life. That's a side effect. They say that's like weeds when you plant hay. I mean, the scriptures say that. You can get it. You can be happy in this life. You will get it. But the motivation has to be that I am working, that I do not go down when I die. And that assumes a lot. That assumes a lot. You know, that assumes that you understand how the mind streams. And that assumes that you even think there's a hell. And we don't truly have that. But as you get older, you develop it. So don't worry. Religious people get... the older people get, the more they start to worry about what will happen after you die.
When you're young, you feel strong and you feel nothing.
Your mind is on the next 10 years at the most, probably the next 2 months normally. But
I don't think it's just when you get older. I think also when you're sick and really sick and you lose your physical power. And
they call that in ancient Christians, they call it goosebump renunciation. It lasts about a week after you get older. No, it's a great effort. It's very difficult to take refuge. It assumes a lot of knowledge. It assumes a lot of thinking. It assumes a lot of observation of death in other people, older people and the people around you. It's not easy. It's very difficult. It's not like taking refuge is easy and bodhicitta is difficult. Taking refuge is very difficult. Really, really becoming a Buddhist is almost impossible. You know, they say, for example, in the monk's vows, I shouldn't say almost impossible. Very
discouraging.
No, they say that we just studied. I just did Vinaya for a month. Monks, you know, that's one of our last subjects. And we reach this part where they say that if a monk takes his vows for any other purpose than renunciation, they don't even stick.
You mean stick?
They don't take form in him. He doesn't get the vow. I mean, he can go around his whole life with the robes on, but he never got the vows.
They're not affecting his consciousness and his
They never grew in his mental state.
So he doesn't get any of the benefits of the vows.
So then there's this long debate about, well, where are we going to find five monks to make new monks? Because it takes five monks to make a new monk. So where are we going to find five monks
Why
in the monastery?
Why does it take 5 months to
make
a new monk?
The ceremony has to be administered by five monks. Which is why there's no nun's vow right now, because it's dropped under five. And then there wasn't enough to give a new
nun's vow. Well, there may be
nun's vow. Being researched. It's being researched. Mm-hmm. And in the Tibetan tradition,
why do you have to have five? Why do you have to five?
Long story. So 10 ways of taking a vow.
No, it's
just
refuge for all the practitioners. The fear of hell.
And address other two. Yeah.
So fear of falling to the lower realm. I would say that is a somewhat altered form motivates a lot of people with a lot of different religious backgrounds, perhaps more in previous generations than it
Oh yeah,
now.
They were, in that sense, that they were ahead of us.
Strong, but I wouldn't say that it required a tremendous amount of knowledge. It was almost a superstitious, impulsive...
Yeah, well that wouldn't be very firm. It wouldn't be very strong.
Oh, I think it was very strong indeed, but it wasn't an intellectual
Oh, maybe.
Thing. It was
maybe
an emotional
thing. I'd say that would be... We call that the Duljatulpo for thick-headed disciples. and better is those who study and understand why hell is very possible. No, just based on what we can see here, knowing the principles of how your mind works, studying the functions of the mind, hell becomes extremely plausible.
Isn't it hell also in this world? What can be in hell
no,
in this world?
No, much worse. It's a bad idea. You know, some Buddhist teachers in the West have said, oh, hell is just a metaphor for depression. No, not correct.
Well, should we think
not
about
not
the
There is a place hell.
Yeah, it is depressed. It's like a real super-duper depressed. Hot one,
yeah. Okay. Ding, what is the motivation of the middle person, the medium person?
To get out of sequence.
Yeah, he wants to get out of this form of life altogether. He understands that it doesn't even matter if you're born in one of the higher realms, like a human realm. It's still suffering. He understands that even this life that we are living, which is the best in the dirty world, in the samsara, in the suffering world, is pain. And that nothing about this life is very nice. None of the comforts you have now will last, period. None of the things you take comfort in, none of the things you work for, none of the things about your health or your looks or your friends or your house or your parents or your family or your children, none of them will last, period. They'll all go. It's just suffering. It's a temporary state. I translated, did I say that? For Yeshe Denin.
Did you?
Many years ago, 20 years ago. That's how these classes started. And he said, health is an accident.
All right.
He said the four elements are... The four elements are going like this, and then sometimes, you know, the four balls are up in the air all spinning right. But the normal condition is illness. You know, the standard condition of a human being is illness.
So the suffering is actually permanent?
No, it can be stopped.
Okay.
But we don't have anything except suffering. The things we believe are our comfort are actually another kind of suffering. The most obvious fact about those comforts is that you lose them. And if you don't think so, wait. You know, everything about your appearance, everything about your health, everything about your work, everything about your intelligence, you will lose it.
How can it be stopped?
That's why we're having class. No, really, okay.
As long as we're in this life, we're going to be in samsara anyway.
Not true.
So can we say here that the goal...
By the way, that's the big time. We're going for the big time. I'm not teaching this class that you go home feeling better, or you're a better justice person, or, you know, we're going for the big time. The purpose of this class is that you don't undergo a normal death, and that you no longer have any kind of suffering. That's the minimum of purpose of this class. It's not that your work goes a little nicer. Or, you know, no.
It's not working.
But still, you got to get old and die. I met this great Korean Japanese master. They said, this is Jo Gwang-gu, you know, and he was able to sit out in the snow for 3 days. And I look at him, I'm waiting. I bought a flower and I waited at the airport. And he came off the airplane and he's like, you know, and he died the next year. He was very old and he was suffering.
Frozen.
No, he was suffering badly. And I thought to myself, well, what does it matter if he sat out in the snow for 3 days? If he's got old, you know, I'm not interested in that.
But it's an achievement. Well, whether you call it the ultimate, it is still an achievement.
Who cares if you die? Who cares if you push your body out in the snow, if your body gets old and wrinkled and dies?
I understand.
Anyway.
It was something that was supposed to happen in his mind.
The middle person, his motivation, is to get out of all forms of suffering life.
Renunciation for cyclic existence.
Yeah, it's what we studied in the first.
It's the motivation, and the goal is nirvana, right?
Well, at minimum, he wants to get out of. He can go shoot for Buddhahood too. That's okay.
No, the middle. The satisfaction of the renunciation of cyclic existence doesn't necessarily
have to do with Buddha. No. Okay. Chembo, what's the big person after?
Can I ask a question about this? About the middle. I get somewhat confused because the idea of, you know, you don't have Mahayana motivation and yet you can escape samsara. I thought you can only escape samsara as a Buddha.
I used to worry about that myself. I used to worry about it a lot. I used to think, how can you get the virtue to perceive emptiness, which is necessary to get nirvana, if you don't love people?
Yeah.
You know, doesn't that virtue imply loving people? They have compassion in the Hinayana scriptures. The Abhidharma teaches compassion. It's not the compassion as it's taught in there. But it's certainly they have love. They have loving kindness, they have compassion.
Even beyond that, though, is thinking, I thought only attaining Buddhahood really gets you out of samsara, not arhat or whatever.
No, arhat is the end of samsara.
It is, even though you're not a Buddha.
Right.
And to be fair, this is a Mahayana description here. Presumably a Hinayana would only have the first two persons.
It's a big debate.
Well, presumably.
It's a big debate. It is a big debate. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's not like they don't accept it automatically. Chembo. Chembo means great. Okay. What is the motivation of the third person? What do you get, man?
To get out of a particular existence for the benefit of all humanity.
And take everybody else with him. Okay. He doesn't want anyone else to suffer. It goes beyond the three lower realms for himself. It goes beyond the three upper realms for himself. It goes out to all realms, all beings. He wants all beings to get out of all suffering. That's why he's going for refuge.
Very fine point. does he want to leave cycle existence also for some?
Nice, beautiful. I love it. That was the next thing. Nice. That was the next point. She said, does he have, what she's basically saying is that, does Chembo also have the motivation of Chungun Jing? Is he interested in getting his own rear end out of the lower three births? Is he interested in getting himself out of the all six kinds of births? On top of wanting everyone else out. Yes. And that's why we call, and you'll see it in your text, the motivation which is shared with lower people. A person who's reached the highest motivation still has, obviously he still has those lower motivations. He wants, the Buddha still has those motivations. The Buddha has no interest in taking birth into hell. Okay? I mean, Buddha Shakyamuni has no, you know, desire to see himself take birth into hell. He still has that motivation.
Isn't it true, in fact, that you can't have the great motivation without the lower?
Yeah, it really is true. Why?
Because
the second of the three.
Yeah,
because, the first.
Yeah, because it's that same feeling turned outward.
Right.
If you don't have the feeling for yourself,
yeah,
you can't have it for others.
Yeah. From the first. Okay. So those are the first three kinds of going for refuge. There's the going for refuge which we share with small motivation people. There's the going for refuge that we share with people of middle motivation. And then there's the going for refuge that the people of large scope. We'll do two more kinds after the break. By the way, okay, we'll come back in about 10 minutes. It's a good place to stop. Anila made some soup, if anybody wants some soup.
Wow.
There's two kinds of soup. I can't tell you much about it.
Gui.
Gyamdo.
Gyamdo.
Not gooey, okay?
Gui.
Gyamdo. Gui, Gyamdo. Okay, this is very interesting. These are, how many Gyamdos we have so far? How many kinds of going for refuge? We have three so far. Okay, there's two more.
Cause.
Okay. Yeah.
Cause and result.
Yeah, this is cause refuge. Okay, cause going for refuge. You have to correct me, like Tom did. I shouldn't say refuge, I should say going for refuge. Cause going for refuge. I always get these two confused, and we'll talk about it, and maybe I'll remember later. Okay. This is to take refuge in some quality which has already been achieved in another person. Like when I go to refuge to Buddha, Shakyamuni, that's Giri Kempa. And this is Debri Kemdo, means result refuge, result going for refuge. And that's where I am taking refuge. This is I like this refuge. In future Michael the Buddha. I'm taking refuge in my future Buddha.
So how is that different than the Buddha Jewel? Going for refuge
result
in the Buddha Jewel?
Oh, it's... Yeah, these are all forms of exceptional refuge. These five, by the way, just I didn't mention that. These are the five divisions of exceptional going for refuge. These are the five divisions of Buddhist refuge going for refuge.
Five divisions of what?
Of a Buddhist going for refuge. These are all going for refuge to the three jewels. So in result refuge, I'm going for shelter in my own future Buddhahood, in my own future Dharma, in my own future Sangha, if I'm not that already.
And the other one?
The other one is to go for refuge to a person other than myself who already has those things in his mind. He already has the three jewels. He already is the three jewels.
Isn't that the Lama?
Could be he's a Dharma jewel.
To a rat.
He has. I could go to the knowledge in the mind of a person who's perceived emptiness. If I go to a refuge
in a Sangha,
in a person who's perceived emptiness, if I go to refuge in his ideas, that's cause refuge. Result refuge is for me to go to refuge in myself, my future self.
So that could even be a subset of the other three, really.
Yeah. This is the raw material of great debate. Yeah. I mean, in the monastery, then you try to figure out the combinations between those five. You know, do they exclude each other or not? You know, it'd be very interesting. I think these two are exclusive.
But what are the, when they say the three refuges in one and the Lama? That's the Lama.
Yeah, no, he has all three. The Buddha has all three. Can you have only one of them? He is all three jewels. Well, his being includes all three jewels. But then you'd have a good debate in the monastery if you said, well, is there anybody who just has one of the jewels? Just one of the jewels.
Who has achieved the resultant one and still is working on the causal other two?
Yeah, no, I mean,
like a Sangha.
Like he is the Dharma jewel, but he's not yet the Sangha jewel. He is the Buddha jewel, but he doesn't have the Dharma.
Well, you could be certainly could be a Sangha jewel before you're a Buddha jewel. In fact,
that's easy. That's the easiest one. You can perceive emptiness directly and be Sangha jewel, but you haven't reached omniscience yet.
I'm a little confused about when you gave a definition of Sangha jewel. You said any person that directly perceives emptiness. Yet in the text you gave us, it said any enlightened being who possesses any one of the eightfold qualities of knowledge or liberation.
Right, good. Good question. No. Good question. Okay. I know what your problem is. It's the word realized. I use the word realized.
Defined in the text.
Well, you have
she's
to be...
The one who translated the text.
She got stuck on the word realized, which is the word which is distinguished from enlightened. Okay, realized doesn't mean enlightened. You can be realized and not be enlightened. Realized means you realize emptiness directly. Enlightened means you know all things. And those are different. That's a distinction that you have to be careful about.
Say realized as opposed to fully realized.
You can say that.
That's
a good way of thinking.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. The way I use the word, realized means a person who has realized emptiness directly.
And enlightened?
And enlightened means a person who knows all things. And that comes much later. You become realized first if you perceive emptiness directly. Then you become enlightened later.
I'm still confused because it seems like they're two separate definitions.
Show me.
Okay, so this text, the Sangha jewel is, I quote, a realized being who possesses any number of the eightfold qualities of knowledge and liberation. But you said in notes, the Sangha jewel is any person who is directly...
Yeah, the first three words of that definition, a realized being,
uh-huh.
That covers it. Anyone who's perceived emptiness directly.
Oh,
you could say any realized being, actually.
To be realized, you have to. You'd have
at least one of the five qualities if you
realized emptiness. Right. Right. Yeah. We didn't go over the five qualities. We will. I mean, I'll do them. What you ask me to do that?
Five qualities.
The last paragraph in English.
I have page 3.
Page 3, sorry. Okay, did I have you?
No, you can keep it.
Okay. I'll just go over the eight qualities of a Buddha really quickly. All right. And these are taken from a book called Uttara Tantra, which is not a Tantra course. Tantra in that book means has a different meaning. You don't need to know all this, okay? It's also by Maitreya, dictated to Asana. And in that book, they give the qualities of the Buddha jewel. And they give eight qualities of the jewel, of the Buddha jewel. The first one here is, he is uncaused. Is the Buddha uncaused?
Really?
If he's uncaused, we're in trouble. We're trying to collect the causes to become a Buddha. Obviously, he's caused.
Oh,
right? Aren't we trying to get together all the causes?
I was wondering. Yeah.
Right. uncaused means this. He is... It's a little bit technical. His Dharma body, his Dharmakaya, is uncaused. What is his Dharmakaya?
It's the truth. You can't really call
it is the emptiness of his mental, of his consciousness. It's the emptiness of his omniscience.
Oh, I understand.
That is the Dharmakaya. The one part of the Buddha's being is emptiness. His emptiness. You now have the emptiness the emptiness of your mental stream is the same emptiness that you will have when you become a Buddha, and that is your Buddha nature.
Yeah, and the same thing can be said of all beings.
No, all beings have the Buddha nature, not because they have something inside that, when uncovered, makes them a Buddha, and, you know, meditate tonight and see it, and you're really a Buddha already, and don't worry, and of course we're not a Buddha already. I'm getting old, my bones are starting to hurt, my teeth are falling out, you know, I'd rather not find something inside, you know.
So in this sense, all beings are unclosed. You could say the same of any
being. Right.
Not just the Buddha.
Technically. But
so that
all
is
of this is talking about, I mean, when you talk about emptiness.
Yeah,
then when you talk about emptiness, then there is no Buddha even. I mean, there is even no.
Well, his Dharmakaya is just emptiness. That emptiness, the emptiness of your mind now, the emptiness of Laura Siegel's mind, will become the emptiness of Laura Siegel, the Buddha. And in that sense, some part of you now will be part of Laura Siegel, Buddha. And that's your Buddha nature. And that's difficult. People have, you know, there are millions of wrong explanations of Buddha nature. We'll study it. We'll get there. It's in this text.
Okay.
Did you have a question, Carolyn?
No. Spontaneous.
Okay. He is spontaneous. Spontaneous means this. This is the, never forget the example of the moon shining at night over the United States, you know, beautiful full moon, no clouds, and every piece of water in the United States that's exposed to the sky will reflect the moon. The moon will jump into every little piece of water, or ocean, or lake, or spring, or anything where there's still water facing the moon. He will appear there. Even your eye, in the water in your eye. You know, I mean, you look up and someone looks at your eye and they'll see the moon in your eye. That's a beautiful idea. The water represents any sentient being who's ready to meet the Buddha. And the moon represents the Buddha. The minute you are ready, the minute you are ripe, he will come to you. And he doesn't have to think. He doesn't say, oh, 4 o'clock, John Stillwell, finally, got renunciation for this afternoon. You know? I better go down and teach him, you know. He just appears. It's part of his incredible virtue from his past life that he will appear in whatever form is useful for you at the exact moment that you're ready for it. And that's one of his qualities. It's a wonderful quality. And that can be the guy on the bus who spits on you. You know, that can be the tree that you run into. He has the power to manifest as that. And he doesn't think about it. He just is it. That's a wonderful idea.
So he will appear again, sorry, whenever?
He'll appear to you throughout the day in any form that you are ready for. That any form that will help you go a little bit further. And maybe it will be someone who attacks you or yells at you. Sound familiar?
Not going to be a nicey-nicey
Buddha. She got a fight with the boss today. Okay.
Huh? So it's not going to be a nicey-nicey Buddha.
It doesn't have to be, but it could be. It could be a beautiful angel, you know.
Yeah.
That's possible.
So even fighting could be a...
Very possible. Very
what about karma? Isn't that karma? I mean, how do you distinguish when it's caused by the karma or your karma?
Well, of course it's caused by karma. Huh? The Buddha can't appear to you if you don't have the karma to have it happen.
So it's not like it's caused by the Buddha. It's just the Buddha is there because
this
is happening to you.
Yeah, because the water is raised. The water is still, and the clouds
are
gone.
Would a dream?
Could be. On one level, the reality in a dream is equal to the reality in waking. Normally it's not. Normally it's an example for unreality in music. But he could appear to you.
No, this is
yeah, it has happened. It's in scripture, it's happened. It happened to a king that really honestly
got it. Yeah, but how can he appear? What do you mean when he appears to you when somebody's angry at you?
No, if it will help you go a little bit further in your practice of Buddhism, it's possible that the Buddha will, out of compassion, come and seem to be your boss and yell at you. It's very possible that emanation has been on this planet for 30 or 40 years, waiting for that moment to help you. Because what's that to a Buddha? You know, I mean, there could be someone you know from childhood.
So you're telling me my boss has an emanation of the Buddha?
Could be. Could be. Could well be.
Good way to think of it.
I have a hard time seeing Buddha in her.
No, it could well be if it helps you go further. If it helps you advance your practice, it could very well be. It could be.
So I guess this is referring, obviously, from the Buddhist side of this thing that you're talking about, it's effortless. And
it's
that's
a reflex.
It's right.
It's a reflex.
And that's what the spontaneousness
is. Yeah, that's what spontaneousness means.
Now, from the side of the person who the Buddha is appearing to,
right.
Obviously you have to... That's also a long process that finally gets that person to the point where they can partake of, and maybe even ignorantly, of
yeah.
this spontaneous
right.
largesse
yeah.
of all Buddhas, right?
Yeah.
So, it sounds like that once you reach that point, then you've made some sort of a breakthrough. I guess it's possible to fall back from that point, or once you get to a certain point, there would be no reason for the Buddha to stop appearing to you. So
there's
it would be
book,
from then
right?
on, the Buddha would be appearing to
why
you all the time.
Why doesn't he appear the way he is? That's what
there's
we recognize.
No, what if,
isn't
what
it
if,
easier?
No, what if he walked, you wouldn't, what if the Buddha walked down the street looking like the Buddha did? You would think he was crazy?
No, I wouldn't.
Yeah,
what do you mean?
By the way, if you wouldn't think that, he would appear to you that way. So the fact that he hasn't appeared to you that way means that you would think that.
So what we have to do right now is to think, okay, you know, we're serious and we're ready and appear to us in a very obvious form and...
Michael, as the Buddha appeared to you...
Okay, wait, we've got to finish. He is realized by no other way. This means that... it's explained that you cannot perceive the Buddha through conceptual means. You can't perceive the Buddha by normal kinds of perception.
Sensory perception?
Is that true? No, not technically. If you lived in India 500 BC, he would have appeared to your senses. This refers to the perception of his Dharmakaya. You cannot see the emptiness of the Buddha without... directly, without a conceptual thought, without some kind of special realization.
So you, 500 years ago, you were seeing Dharmakaya?
His Nirmanakaya. His movie body.
His actual body?
It's not his... Well, there's a debate. I mean, he's got four bodies. Who knows which is the real one? But that's the movie body. That's the one he just shows. You know?
The movie body?
It's
the hologram.
You could say hologram is pretty good. He just pretended to show it. He's not like that. That's not his real form.
Almost like an invisible body, almost.
No, it's a visible one that you can see. If he doesn't show that body, you can't see him, because his real body is up in paradise, and you don't have the goodness to see it. So Buddhas, out of compassion, try to show themselves as a normal human being. It's very similar to the idea of Jesus Christ. Okay. The next three are very important, and they come together, and that's why they are all blocked out that way. He has knowledge, love, and power. There's a very famous debate about the Buddha. Knowledge here means he's aware that we are suffering. He's aware of our condition. So it doesn't help if someone's aware of your condition if they don't care anything about you. So then love comes. Okay, that's the way the debate goes. You know, okay, he knows I'm in trouble. But if he said, I'm busy today, let them suffer over there. So he has love. But it's also no good that if a person had knowledge that you're suffering, and if he cared about you, if he couldn't do anything about it, and that's power. He does have the power to do something about it. So he has those three qualities. He has the power to know perfectly your suffering. He has the power... I mean, he cares about it. He's concerned. And then finally, he has the ability to do something about it. What can he do? The Dalai Lama, the first Dalai Lama, in his text on the Abhidhamma Kosha, in the opening pages, it's very beautiful. And there's a very famous quotation, and he says, look, the Buddha can't come to you and sprinkle holy water on your head and take your suffering away. And he can't transfer his knowledge to you, you know, with some kind of meditation, and then suddenly you understand what he understands. He has to talk. He has to communicate to you. It's the only way. It's the only normal way. I mean, in extraordinary cases.
But those extraordinary cases would be the result of a lot of talking. That
right, right. Yeah, that's so true. I mean, the Buddha has to appear to you as a human being, normally.
Teach you.
And he has to teach you. And that's his nupa. That's his power. That is the extent of his power.
Nupa.
His power to teach you.
But, so then it would be like, for example, you could be a Buddha.
There's a long debate about it.
Maybe you are.
I'm not. Maybe you are.
Maybe he's just
kind of
wrong.
Okay. No.
Boy, that's like,
who the hell are you?
There was a
I was going to hang out in New York, you know?
There's a famous debate my teacher told me a debate that happened like 40 years ago in Hawaii. The Buddha is not supposed to have any words, you know? So it came down to this heavy debate in front of thousands of monks. The guy said, "Well, what are you? I'm the Buddha. You're the Buddha." He said, "Yeah, I am the Buddha. Okay, I am the Buddha." "No, you're not, because you have a wart on your chin."
He pulled out a box of acne warts.
Okay, anyway, he has satisfied both the needs. The last thing is this is an interesting point. I mean, he has satisfied his own needs and he has satisfied our needs.
I'm on 7. Where are you? I'm at 7.
Own and 8.
4, 5, 6.
Oh,
the 2 needs. Satisfy the 2 needs.
Yeah, you're right.
Who's the 1? Buddha's the 1. Is that anything?
No, it's not. It's not 8. It's not 1 of them.
No, you have 2 needs.
Yours is 2 needs.
So that's 8.
Yeah,
7 and 8.
Yours and others.
Last time you asked a question.
Yeah, and I'm still asking that question. I like you wrote it down. It's fine. Okay, I'll get to it right now. He has fulfilled his own needs, obviously. He doesn't suffer anymore. He's living in a nice paradise. His body is like a rainbow, it's a diamond. He has no suffering. He's very happy. As happy as anyone could ever be. But how, by becoming a Buddha, has he fulfilled my needs? And then the text says, well, there's a big debate about it. And people say, well, I'm still suffering, so he didn't fulfill my needs. And then, or for example, when they talk about the perfection of giving, they say, how can the Buddha have perfected giving if there's still poor people around? So he didn't perfect giving. There's still poor people around. No, the point is, in this case, that he has satisfied our needs and that he is totally available and capable to teach us.
We just have to take refuge.
We don't have the virtue to have it happen.
Well, before you even have that, you have to have the refuge. You have to take the refuge, right?
Yeah, so he has fulfilled our needs. We haven't taken
advantage. Some people wouldn't want to take refuge in a Buddhist Yeah. So what's the Buddha going to do? Excuse me, I'm going to give you this anyway, you know?
I think fulfilled is a funny verb there.
It's meant to be there. It's Shenzhen Pinsok. Pinsok. That's the Ernstest monk's name. And Aniba loves to make fun of him for it. But it means totally, totally fulfilled, totally complete, taken care of, finished, perfect, finito, you know. And so it's very controversial, you know. How can he have fulfilled my needs if I'm still here? But he has. So it's a tricky verb. And then we debate about it for weeks. That word.
May I ask if you personally are comfortable with that? It's totally comprehensible, or it's one of the...
The deeper you get into Buddhism, the more you see how everything fits perfectly together. And at first, there are things that seem contradictory, and that's okay. It's okay. It will, and to say it's not, or to pretend it's not, is a kind of... It's not acceptable in Buddhism. You have to question it. Okay.
But Michael, why doesn't the Buddha appear to us? This way, Peter, why?
You're not ready. You don't have the goodness to appear to you. It's a good karma to have him appear to you. To have the Dalai Lama appear to you is an incredible good karma. To go to Arizona and hear him talk for 5 days is some kind of incredible goodness that we collected to be there.
But it was really $200 you had to get, really.
Okay, that was part of the cover, too. Okay, why take refuge? And then we'll stop. We're doing pretty good. He says that temporal purpose is that they can provide you the highest form of protection. The ultimate purpose is to attain enlightenment. And that short-term purpose is that there is no better protection in this life. You know, if you're worried about some danger in this life, you know, not even talking big time, go for refuge. Take refuge. It can help you. It is the only thing that will help. For example, to do Tonglen, you know, to do this practice of taking on other people's suffering, or pretending that you could, or fantasizing that you could, is really the best protection against that kind of suffering. It's actually a very powerful cause not to have that kind of suffering yourself, to have a true desire that other people might have it, or that you could take it from other people onto yourself. It's actually one of the sweetest protections against it. That's the kind of refuge.
Michael, when you think about if you, without doing the palm lane, right? I was thinking about how you can apply it every day, and you see somebody suffering, and you say, well, I wish that I had this on myself this way. I don't see this person suffering. Right. And what happened at one point, I realized, and some, you know, I was thinking all those things, and then I said, my goodness, I'm going to be all sick. I'm not going to be able to help anybody.
Not like that.
Not like that. No. I figured that was the wrong way.
Sorry. Yeah, no, not like that. So that's temporarily, I mean, of all the protections in the world, this is the best protection. If you get protection from some other source, let's say a policeman, if you're in trouble, or a judge, if you have a court case, or a doctor, if you're sick, the reason you are getting help from them has nothing to do with them, right? It's because of something you did. You've treated other people, you gave other people medicine, you helped other people. That's why the doctor is effective for you. There's this thing in Buddhism about you go to different countries and the same medicine will have different effects on different people in different countries. And you can see it in India. You know, you can give the same medicine to somebody. There's whole countries where medicine is not as effective to the same population. It's a karma of the medicine. If there's anything about medicine that helps you, if there's any reason a policeman happens to be around when you're being mugged, if there's any reason you win a court case, it has nothing to do with the judge or the policeman or the doctor. It's your own goodness. So taking refuge is the ultimate protection. Taking refuge in your own knowledge of karma, for example, being moral, is the ultimate protection. It's very interesting. Giving is the ultimate poverty solution. It's very interesting. It's very... very interesting, and it works. Try it. I mean, in the tantric texts, I can tell you, Changya Rupa Dorje says...
Should you impoverish yourself? Oh, that's...
Do it in the, you can't. Try it. You know? Mm-hmm. Pick a big object. I mean, pick something holy. And give. You know? And you will not be poor. The Buddha makes a vow when he became a Buddha. He said, if anybody who tries to follow morality... doesn't get fed, you know, let me not be Buddha, then Buddhahood is a big lie, you know. Try it, you'll find that it works, and it's actually the basis for all the higher, for the secret teachings, you know, that idea is very important, and it just works, and that's the cause of things, it's not anything else.
You mean ultimately? I mean, there's still some connection between getting out of bed and going to work and getting that paycheck. I mean, you know, you don't get it if you stay in bed.
Some people do.
Yes, but that's what
I do.
What's the long term? What's the long term?
I want to do one more short term. One more short term is you can take vows. All the vows, there's three kinds of vows you can take. One are the what we call the freedom vows, which are monk's vows, or the lifetime vows for lay people, which I hope you will all take someday. And I think we'll take that, we'll work on that. You know, we'll talk about, we'll study the whole thing so that you know what you're doing, which is very nice.
sometimes.
We'll go through that. There's 7 lifetime vows. There's 1 day vow. You can take the 1 day vow anytime. We can take it together sometime. And then there's 7 lifetime vows, and 2 of those can be taken. Yeah, the first 3 can be taken by, the first 3 vows, meaning the 1 day vow and 2 layman vows, can be taken by people who still are living not as a monk or a nun. You can take those vows for the rest of your life. You don't have to shave your head or wear robes or give up family life. And they're very nice to take. You should take them. So those are the first kind of vows. The second kind of vows are bodhisattva vows.
Freedom vows, monk's vows?
Monk's vows are 1 of the 8 kinds of freedom vows. The freedom vows are vowed morality, basically.
And the lifetime vows are also part of freedom vows?
Yeah, there's 2 kinds of freedom vows. There's 8 types of freedom vows. Yini, gini, pama, nangeja, pama, gilama, gilama, nangeja, pama, gilama, 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 8 of them.
And the vows for lay people are 7 total?
No. The first 3 of the 8 can be taken by lay people. The last 5 can only be taken by people who lead. But they all constitute what we call freedom vows.
I see. Thank you very much.
All 8. And you have to take those sometimes. The next level of vows up are bodhisattva vows. Dr. Shin and Chino Mudishi, Shakyamuni, and his Koya Koya Chikun, something like that, etc. You know, Tundu. And then the secret vows are the 3rd level of vows. And each one is higher than the one below it. To take any of those vows, you must take refuge. As I just said, for a monk, if I try to take monk's vows without the intention of trying to get out of suffering, they don't stick, they don't grow. And it's even, we'll study the whole thing so that you know what you're doing, which is very nice.
sometimes.
We'll go through that. There's 7 lifetime vows, there's 1 day vow. You can take the 1 day vow anytime. We can take it together sometime. And then there's 7 lifetime vows, and 2 of those can be taken. Yeah, the first 3 can be taken by, the first 3 vows, meaning the 1 day vow and 2 layman vows, can be taken by people who still are living not as a monk or a nun. You can take those vows for the rest of your life. You don't have to shave your head or wear robes or give up family life. And they're very nice to take. You should take them. So those are the first kind of vows. The second kind of vows are bodhisattva vows.
Freedom vows, monk's vows?
Monk's vows are 1 of the 8 kinds of freedom vows. The freedom vows are vowed morality, basically.
And the lifetime vows are also part of freedom vows?
Yeah, there's 2 kinds of freedom vows. There's 8 types of freedom vows. Yini, gini, pama, nangeja, pama, gilama, gilama, nangeja, pama, gilama, 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 8 of them.
And the vows for lay people are 7 total?
No. The first 3 of the 8 can be taken by lay people. The last 5 can only be taken by people who lead. But they all constitute what we call freedom vows.
I see. Thank you very much.
All 8. And you have to take those sometimes. The next level of vows up are bodhisattva vows. Dr. Shin and Chino Mudishi, Shakyamuni, Koya Koya Chikun, something like that, etc. You know, Tundu. And then the secret vows are the 3rd level of vows. And each one is higher than the one below it. To take any of those vows, you must take refuge. As I just said, for a monk, if I try to take monk's vows without the intention of trying to get out of suffering, they don't stick, they don't grow. And it's even more true for the higher vows.
When you say you don't get the vows, that also means you don't get any of the benefits?
You get, of course. I mean,
it's much smaller.
And you're trying to keep it and everything. Yeah. But it's not, it doesn't have, there's 6 effects that vows have. And it doesn't have that effect. Obviously, to keep your morality, even if you don't have a vow for it, is great. But you won't, You can't have a vow take its true effect if you don't have renunciation. If you're taking it for any other reason, it won't have its true effect. If you're taking it because everyone else around you is taking it, or you're taking it because somebody said you should take it, or you're taking it because you look smart, or you're taking it because it seems nice, or if you don't take it to get out of suffering, it doesn't have its full effect. So what they say is that one of the benefits of going for refuge is that you can take vows. And if you don't go for refuge, the vow is not going to... Either it won't stick or it won't be very...
Michael, meaningful. You said that there's order... Which one? The highest, I would say, is the secret vows.
Yeah.
And then the highest. And then the next highest, Bodhisattva.
Yeah.
And then freedom vows.
Yeah. And most of us haven't gotten to the freedom vows. And most of us haven't gotten to the little person's
the refuge.
We're not Buddhists, hey. We're just talking about it. Kick the ball around.
No, and it's as you get older, you will appreciate it. You'll see the truth of it. You know, I mean, to really be practicing Dharma, it has to be largely motivated by death. As you get closer, and it's sweet to have it ready in your hand, even though you didn't appreciate it fully. When the time comes, you've already got it ready. That's very useful. Okay, the ultimate benefit is obvious. You can reach Buddhahood. If you don't keep vows, if you don't do what Bodhisattvas do, and specifically if you don't take and keep the secret vows, you can't achieve Buddhahood in this
straight.
Yes, I'm memorizing the book down there. What is that?
I'm sorry,
would
you say
that?
I didn't get that.
It took the Buddha like 75,000 kalpas to collect. That was the first period of his collection of books. Then the next one was 76,000 kalpas. I mean, you can do it in one life if you
want. I want a consultation with somebody who can tell me how many.
If you take refuge, then you can take the secret vows. And if you take the secret vows, you can, and if you keep them, you can reach Buddhahood in this life.
So
it.
The secret vows are tantra vows.
Yeah. Tantra means secret.
So if we did a Kala Chakra initiation, I think we took secret vows, but of course I personally didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, that's why...
it's a seed, isn't it?
You could have the vows, but they could be decimated by now. You know what I mean? I mean, no, my monk vows are similar. You know, I'm just finding out after 10 years. I'm studying them in deep detail. And if we have broken them, then they are injured forever. You know, they are like damaged, and I'm very sad to learn that I've done some of them and I didn't
Why
know the
details. Why
are they
injured for us?
Everything
to be missed.
They take a big hit, you know. That's how it's described. And if you don't hide it, if you openly confess to your abbot or an older monk or, in your case, your lama or whatever. You can restore it a lot. The word is called chirchubo or sojo. You can restore it pretty well, but it'll never be like it was before you broke it the first, before you damaged it.
They're always giving you vows.
You don't lose the vows. to lose a freedom vow, you have to die or give it back. There's three other ways you can do it, but you probably won't do it. You could change your sex three times. And there's some other ones like that.
Only in New York.
By the way, I should mention one more, which is called Getsache. Well, you can do that. Getsache is to give up Buddhism. So this is all bullshit. You know, karma is bullshit. This is all meaningless. You know, that thought makes you lose your vows. But aside from that, luckily, you can have them decimated and you can still keep them.
So then you have the idea.
But the way they give you the vows without giving you, like, the guidebook
very,
for,
very
like,
improper.
You know.
Yeah, it's generally...
They'll give anyone vows at any initiation, and they'll give you monks and nuns vows, apparently, without you knowing what they are.
No, you have to... Ideally, you should study them deeply.
It won't tell you what they are.
No, the purpose of a cross check is we'll go through them. We'll do them in detail. Tsongkhapa, the first book in Tsongkhapa's collected works is a huge book on those two dogs. It's very
the whole thing is an accumulative process as well. I doubt if you would find many Buddhas who, you know, at one point in their career, they finally took vows, and it was perfectly, you know,
it kept them
kept the whole time. I think it happens over and over again to everyone.
Oh, no, but you have to have the intention to keep them. I mean, you have to take them knowing what they are and with a true intent to keep them pure.
And then sometime at a very mature point in someone's career, they'll be born somewhere, they'll take vows, and they'll have kept them really nicely the whole time, and everyone will say, wow, you know. And it's like, yeah, sure, after 10 million lifetimes of breaking or something.
Okay,
you
gotta...
You have to stop now. The dog is barking. It's fine.
The motivation of taking a vow has to involve... By the way, the vows also do not form if in the back of your mind you think... well, they all sound pretty good except that one, you know? And,
what about drinking beer?
That one is a little, I can probably just keep most of them on, and then I'll be all right. That motivation prevents the vow from performing, as far as Vinaya vow.
What about the idea of, well, I'll try them, and if it doesn't work, then I'll just, you know.
No, that's also, it won't perform properly because it's a lifetime vow.
That's what you do for one day.
The one day vow will work. But someone was telling me, oh, my friend said I could become a monk for 3 years, and no.
You can do that in the Hinayana tradition.
There's a custom in Burma, Thailand, in fact, if your government, you get a government pension for the period, you can leave work for 3 months, and your employer is required to let you go. And you can become a monk for like 3 months, and then, come back.
Every year? Or?
No, like once in your life, you're supposed to be, what, age 20 or something? Or?
Yeah,
21.
Like compulsory.
I thought you
could. It's not compulsory, but a lot of people do it, and it's interesting, the effect in Thailand is if you can meet a bellboy or you can meet a taxi driver, which I have met, and they'll start explaining Vipassana to you. And I like, that's a nice thing, but technically it's not in the Vinaya. Technically, there's seven lifetime vows and there's one day vow, and there ain't nothing else in any tradition of the original vow. So that's a custom, and it's a good custom. I think it's a helpful custom. I think it makes all the men I've met in Thailand, and many of the men had a good knowledge of Buddhism from that. The king himself did that, right?
I'm not sure.
No, he did. Very nice. That's a nice thing. Look at George Bush.
People want to have to meditate in the cave for 3 years before they can run for president. They don't want to do it.
You can't give up your vows and then take them back.
You can.
You can.
A monk can. It's technically possible, but it's very extraordinary and not. If you take a vow with the intention of giving it back and later taking it again, it won't work.
No, not with the intention, but at some point, then you give it, and then you can take it
back. Properly give it back, but at which time you're blind, because you swore to keep it for your life.
But at the time you swore, you meant
to. No, I know.
And you had the intention to, so it's not a lie.
Oh, sure. You swear. You say, I will keep this for my life. You have to swear, or else you don't get the vow.
So it's a partial karma you collect.
So it's very undesirable. Technically, it's possible.
So if we blow our vows for, let's say those of us who took the Kali Chakra vow, and we didn't even know what we were doing, right?
Yeah. Which is a higher vow.
Which is a higher vow than a monk's vow.
No, but the technicalities of the secret vows are different.
Okay, we didn't know what we were doing, so we've already blown them because we didn't even know what we were doing. Should we bother to even attempt to do the practice?
Obviously, yes. Of course you should. And then you should try. One more thing. Taking vows, you can restore by taking initiative.
Is it the same? They take the big hit and they're not as
strong?
Same idea?
No.
It's not?
You can take them again and they're pure.
Oh.
As I understand it, but I can't talk about it yet. And luckily, because I don't know much about it.
Same with the Bodhisattva?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Same with the Bodhisattva book?
Et cetera.
You can take them over there.
So, I mean, you get the same sort of crippling effect of breaking.
I don't know that chemically.
It doesn't sound like it. Depends on whether they're secondary downfalls or root downfalls.
Yeah, I don't believe you don't lose them the way that a monk
might.
And I'm sorry we ran home, and I will not do it. I don't think.
Watch out for the line.
All the qualities that we
screwed up. Yeah, that's
my problem. We don't babble.
And that happens to me. First time I've done this one. I forgot to mention last week that after every class, two people have to stay and help vacuum and wash dishes. Did you volunteer, or is that a yawn? Okay, year one, who's going?
Lee and I are going to go.
Okay.
I think I do that. Thank you.
So one does the vacuum cleaner and one does the dishes.
This is the end of Class 2.